Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
Hi, welcome back to Your Family Dog. Today, Julie and I are joined by Dr. Chris Paukel, one of the few veterinary behaviorists in the world. There really are only about 70, right, Chris? Is that what it is, about 70?
That's right. I think we're in the high 70s now, but we're gaining ground. We're building steam and or whatever that phrase might happen to be. But yeah, we're not that popular quite yet.
Yeah, which it's so awesome that it's building steam because it's such an important thing. So today we invited you to talk a little bit about puppy socialization. But if you could just take a really brief minute and tell us what a veterinary behaviorist is and how that's different from our regular veterinarian.
Absolutely. So a veterinary behaviorist is someone who really comes at behavior cases from a variety of angles. So we have training in learning theory and brain development and kind of the way that animals learn. And we also have extensive information from the veterinary side. So understanding how physiology and hormone levels and medications and disease and illness and how all of those things impact behavior, as well as potentially impacting learning and the development of individual behavior patterns and problems. So we're kind of looking at both of those pieces that you might be able to get from, let's say, working with a really skilled trainer or behavior consultant and working with a veterinarian, but we have the knowledge base of both to really marry those two things and kind of flex back and forth depending on what an individual animal needs from us.
Which is awesome.
That is awesome. Absolutely awesome. So one of the questions I had for you is that in the throes of trying, a lot of people try to socialize their dog. I don't think socialization is quite of a novel concept as it used to be. But sometimes what happens is dogs get traumatized in the name of socialization. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and what the ramifications for that might be for dogs and for their owners.
No, I certainly can. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, in my clinical practice, at least, whereas now I'm working with mostly animals who have a behavior problem of some sort, of any nature. And historically, we are often talking about under socialization. And now I'm finding there's a very distinct subset where when I go back and I ask the clients, you know, what did those first 3 to 16 weeks look like? They're giving me all sorts of examples that include going to Home Depot and we went to the park and we went to puppy class and we went to all of these different locations. And so from that standpoint, socialization was happening. And yet when we dig just a little bit deeper and we ask the client, you know, well, what did you see during those socialization experiences? How did your puppy actually respond? What we're describing at those points is often more of a puppy who is shy, reserved, who wasn't actually social or interactive, who was in some cases actually starting to show early signs of defensiveness. And the clients in those cases were so focused on exposure, and they weren't aware or perhaps didn't know how to recognize what some of those early signs of emotional distress might look like. And so that's where that trauma in the name of socialization really starts to come through. And what we have is a pup who was absolutely exposed, but they equated that exposure with a negative rather than something that was, you know, positive or even neutral would be better than negative. And so we're actually teaching these pups that certain experiences are going to be more than they can handle. And if anything, it encourages them to be a bit more defensive or a bit more avoidant. And we see those patterns that show up in a variety of ways later on.
Yeah, and it's all done with these great intentions. Oh, look, he's a little bit worried about big guys. So I took him around a lot of big guys. Oh, not quite. I often liken it to a child's first visit to Santa Claus. Like, we all think that should be awesome. But there are very few men in your child's life who have a long white beard and a big red suit and want you to sit on his lap. And we're like, this is fun, and it's happy. And the children are shying away. And the parents are going, smile, it's fun, take a picture. And the kids are like, ah. That's exposure, not socialization. So we really want to see if we can, from our puppy perspective, say, this is supposed to be fun. And if it isn't fun, what can I do to make it fun?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely something that I think is how would I say, just not talked about enough. It's underexplored. It's and I get it. I mean, gosh, you know, new puppy owners have just an incredible amount of information that they've got to try to absorb, you know, and we're talking about health issues and vaccination plans and parasite control and potty training and crate training and teaching them how to bite their toys and not people and, you know, all of these things that it's really difficult to get to some of those more subtle nuances. And so I get it. And I'm grateful that people are making that attempt to socialize. And, you know, I think we're at the next place where we need to start kind of taking that next level to say, yes, the goal is this, and let's make sure that your puppy is actually enjoying the experience versus not.
So what happens then if we've traumatized a puppy in our best interests? First of all, how would a person recognize that, oh, I've gone too far? And then, if we've gone too far, how do we deal with the after effects of that? What are your suggestions?
Great question. And I think it's going to depend a little bit on where and when we recognize that we've gone too far. You know, if we're working with an 11-week old puppy and, you know, we made the attempt to, let's say, take that dog to the park and, you know, had everything set up appropriately and we had one child, and then all of a sudden we were overwhelmed by a soccer team, you know, but it's sort of a one-time event, then we really just have to look and see, did that puppy bounce back appropriately? Mm-hmm. So was it just a situational, whoa, too much, and we can just regroup, reset, and go right back to life as usual? Or are we seeing any residual effects from that? Or if we're actually catching it later on, maybe now we're catching it at, let's say, 6 months or 9 months, and we're recognizing that, whoa, I don't think this pup was having a good time. Well, truly at that point, the socialization window, that primary opportunity, not only for learning about experiences for the first time, but also the way that socialization impacts neurologic development, that window has closed. And so if we're catching it truly after the fact, you know, weeks to months later, we may really be looking more at desensitization and counter conditioning more so than socialization at that point in time. And that's really where we kind of have to figure out, what does this particular dog need? Is it naive enough that we can say, okay, let's just try again?
Yeah.
Or is there enough of a negative response that we say, gosh, now we really have to break this down and do all of the desensitization and counter conditioning steps that we might do with other animals as well?
Well, one of my questions is, what happens if a dog has more than one traumatic experience? So if you're frightened by a child at the park, that may be difficult for the dog. But what if you're walking on the way home from the park and some kid comes flying by on a scooter and startles the dog? Or you go by a stroller and some kid is screaming. So you have more than one traumatic event within a short period of time. What kind of an effect can that have on a puppy? And is that going to cause a more serious problem?
You know, it really depends, you know, as sort of the true behaviorist or behavior consultant always answers, right? It depends, but it really does. And so what I'm looking at there is, you know, again, it's a matter of, when are we catching this? And where I think those different experiences are going to differently impact the developmental pathways of the puppy is perhaps going to depend a little bit more on that pup's level of resilience. So if we have a pup who has almost an immediate bounce back, who spooks and startles, gives that little puppy version of a shake off, and we're right back into full engagement again, then having a couple of different bad experiences may not have much in the way of any sort of reaction. With that being said, if we have a pup who has either not recovered yet and then gets spooked or startled or scared or overwhelmed again, we may be seeing something more of a trigger stacking event. And the worry that I have there, if the pup hasn't fully recovered, is that, you know, gosh, it might have even been that had the only negative thing been that scooter going by, the pup might have actually handled it okay. But the fact that they were already a bit above, you know, maybe not over threshold, but they weren't back to full baseline comfort either. They were still just a little bit more susceptible. And so they responded in a negative way to that second trigger. And that's where I think we can really get almost a cumulative impact. Mm-hmm. And that's where it really becomes relevant that, at least to a basic level, pet owners are able to determine, you know, is my puppy, you know, red, green, or yellow, basically, you know, green light, soft, wiggly, approach, yellow, maybe just a little on the tentative or slow side, or red, truly frozen, non-responsive, or avoidant in those situations. And I don't think that every puppy owner necessarily needs to know every single body language cue that might be ever right. displayed by any puppy. But they probably need to have at least a basic vocabulary of what that's likely to look like for their puppy so they can make a judgment call, just like we would with kids, to say, hey, you know what? This is a bit much right now. Let's pause, let's regroup, and let's try again.
Yeah. And perhaps with a different plan when we try again.
Yes, absolutely. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about trigger stacking, what that is and how that would affect a dog, because I think that's something that most people don't think about, that there may be more than one thing that is causing it a behavior problem. And if you put those things on top of one another, then your reaction is going to be more severe. But if you could just talk a little bit more about trigger stacking and what owners might be looking for or what that might mean for them, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that trigger stacking is one of those things that, well, at least in my experience, is easier to identify after the fact.
Yes.
Then some.
Yes, absolutely.
In the moment, which is hard because it's already happened. So there's nothing we can do about it at that point. But what trigger stacking really refers to is, let's say we've got a puppy who is a little bit tentative around, let's say, an unfamiliar adult man. And so they're just a little bit cautious or a little bit tentative, but they're okay. You know, they're quote unquote fine around that man. But now let's say we're also at a park and we happen to be at a park that's next to a major roadway. So now we add in traffic noise. And if traffic noise was the only thing that puppy was experiencing, maybe that puppy would also be quote unquote fine. But when we add, let's say, the unfamiliar man to the traffic noise, to, you know, add in multiple other triggers if they're present, we can basically exceed that individual puppy or adult dog's ability to cope. And a little bit of this, plus a little bit of this, and a little bit of this, and a little bit of this, and all of a sudden, it's just too much. And that's where we really see trigger stacking in its sort of the classic sense of the word. And what it usually means, and actually what I find when I'm talking with a lot of my clients, is that it comes across as a pup who seems to be maybe even almost unpredictable. They were fine with this guy, but they weren't fine with this guy. They were fine with the traffic over here, but not over here. And it's not until we tease out the individual variables that we say, oh, this is a dog who has a couple of little triggers that when added together, it has a much bigger impact for that pup. But again, that's after the fact. Mm-hmm. So it's harder to recognize. And so, you know, I think that's great to understand. And yet I tend to go right back to body language, that we don't always know in the moment what it is that's causing that emotional shift. But if we're recognizing the body language that the pup is showing us, we can at the very least just sort of regroup and try again, perhaps a little bit more intentionally with a plan.
Right. And one of the things when I'm talking to people about trigger stacking, it's for them to understand that there's more than one thing that their dog is sensitive to. So they need to be sensitive to the environment. So for me, trigger stacking becomes valuable as a way to tell them, this is what you need to be looking to keep your dog safe. So if you're at a playground that's by a busy road, you might want to be in the back of the playground, as far away from the road as you can be, and not allow strangers to come by him or whatever it is. So you're right. You kind of find out about it afterwards, but it can help owners set up a better plan for their puppy.
Yeah.
And so that the counter conditioning you're going to have to do is going to be more effective because the dog's not going to be in the overwhelmed state.
And what that really brings up, Julie, which I think is just a brilliant way of saying that, is we have to be looking for every variable that is a factor for that puppy. We have to, at least at a basic level, be aware of what that stimulus gradient actually looks like. So if we have a pup who's sensitive to people, we may be having to pay attention to proximity or distance. We may have to pay attention to number of individuals present. We may be paying attention to body language and whether or not they're big gestures or little ones, or the tone of voice or the volume of speech patterns. You know, and so those individual stimulus gradients will come together in a variety of combinations. And that, I think, is often really two things. It's really evident that a lot of owners and maybe a lot of trainers or veterinarians aren't seeing all of that variables when they say, gosh, today was just the same as yesterday. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not, you know, and that's where it gets confusing. And back to the sort of, you know, the idea of trauma in the name of socialization, it's not hard to see why some of these pups might have some overwhelming experiences, because we just don't always know or have the ability to see all of those things in advance to know exactly what's going to be a trigger or not for an individual little pup.
And the thing is that it can be, too, that the internal environment of the pup, you may have exactly the same day, the exact same number of people or whatever, but the internal state of the pup is different that day. Like, maybe yesterday I played too hard and I'm tired today, or, you know, my back is sore because, you know, this little person leaned on me, or whatever. So
or
sometimes
a tree
we don't
is
even
cut
know.
Down at a neighbor's house, and it was noisy at my house all day.
Exactly. Yeah. Internal versus out. You know, internal versus external environmental factors, and yeah, it all matters. Yeah,
it does.
And I find when we're working with those pups, you know, again, whether it's in the veterinary clinic or in puppy class, you know, if we're working with a naive pet owner, and I, when I say naive, I'm not talking about that in a negative way. They just don't know all of that information yet. It's so difficult to get all of it in such a short time window for that true socialization window. It's so hard.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about socialization windows? Because I've heard lots of different things, anywhere from 12 weeks to 16 weeks. And is that variable by dog, by breed, by size? What do you generally say?
Yes, all of those things. Yeah, there's a couple of things that really are relevant there. And that it's, I never want people to think about socialization as like, boom, it's 3 weeks, door is open, 12 weeks, boom, the door is closed. You know, it's not that. You know, there are sort of gray areas on either side of that. It's basically looking at, you know, at what age do we see that pup starting to have, you know, experiences, not only sort of nutrition and elimination experiences with their mother, but when are they starting to form social relationships and have direct peer-to-peer social interactions and really starting to navigate their environment and investigate and do all of those things. You know, that's kind of the early side of that. And then the end of that is really anywhere in that 12 to 16 week window. And depending on which reference you look at, you're going to find it listed in different ways. And so what I like to think about for the individual variation is, you know, we're looking at an approximate window from 3 up to probably 14 to 16 weeks. But again, it's not just, you know, this neat, clean bookend. The reason one of the reasons why there's a lot of individual variation is that it depends on other factors as well. And so, you know, I mentioned briefly resilience, but there's so many factors that go into socialization, including genetics and the prenatal rearing environment, you know, the nutritional state of the mother, the pups before the pups were even born, the emotional state of the mother before the pups were even born, whether or not those pups were handled at even a basic level during those first, you know, 3 weeks or so. all of those things kind of give us a different level of susceptibility and a different initial trajectory of neurologic development that then has an impact on the degree of susceptibility or need for that pup. And so the moment we start thinking that every puppy is the same, or that every 3-week-old puppy is the same blank slate, you know, not really. There's a lot of individual variation. And I know that we have to create these sort of broad brush strokes so that we're getting the majority of the pups captured, but there are going to be outliers. There's going to be variants, and that's where we really have to be paying attention to what's happening, especially if we're seeing a pup that's a bit more on that shy, sensitive, avoidant, susceptible side. That's a place where you know, those pups perhaps do need a lot more true socialization, but at a lower intensity, a greater level of awareness of that stimulus gradient, so that we're not overwhelming either with individual triggers or with those cumulative triggers like we were talking about with trigger stacking.
This is awesome and so helpful.
It really is.
And we're going to wrap up this episode here, but lucky you, Dr. Chris Pockel is coming back for another episode to talk about something else. But let me really quick, before we sign off on this one, tell you how you could find him. You can reach him at animalbehaviorclinic.net and learn all about the amazing work he does as a veterinary behaviorist. And of course, tune into the next episode because there's lots more fun to come. Thanks so much, Chris. We appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.